Hi, and welcome to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We're so excited you've joined us today. Our hope is that God uses this message to help you experience a deeper, life-changing relationship with Jesus, because Jesus changes everything. Enjoy today's message.
If you have a Bible, you can turn to Ecclesiastes 11. We're getting towards the end of the book, Ecclesiastes 11. And as we're walking through this book, this fascinating and in many ways very, very difficult book, I hope that you've picked up on one of the themes, one of the really central themes is that life is a gift to be enjoyed. And sometimes we get confused and we start to think that life is something that we have to attain, that it's a trophy that we win and we put it on a shelf. And so we try to chase after all these things to give our lives meaning. But actually the way that God has designed life is that we receive it as a gift, and so we're supposed to enjoy it. We don't gain it and put it on a shelf. We enjoy it for all that it's worth and the time that we have. But it raises a question, doesn't it? Why don't we enjoy life more? I mean, I don't know about you, but I look around and I see a lot of people who don't seem to be enjoying life very much. And I got to tell you, I have days where I don't really enjoy my life as much as I wish that I did. So what is that about? Why don't we enjoy life more? And it doesn't really matter, as I've looked around, right, who you are. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're rich or whether you're poor. It doesn't matter whether you have kids or don't have kids, or whether you're married or single, or whether you've got lots of stuff or nothing, or you know, whether you've got the dream job or not the dream job, or the education or not the education. There are so many people, as I look around, that are living lives that I would just characterize as numb. There's just this apathy that exists within our society today. And we're burdened by this sense of almost like boredom, like passivity, just sort of we exist and maybe we chase after a carrot or two, but is that really all that life is supposed to be? And I think that one of the clues, if you will, that begins to open up for us this idea of why don't we enjoy life. I think in some ways, the whole book of Ecclesiastes, we could go all the way through it and Solomon keeps unpacking for us different ways that we miss out on the enjoyment of life that God desires us to experience. But one of the clues that I think that gets at sort of this existential angst that we all sort of feel can be found in kind of an unusual place. I think of it from the aisle of cereal in Walmart. You ever seen the cereal aisle at Walmart? It's overwhelming. Right, there's just so much cereal. In fact, when I was living in Italy, I came back and I moved back and I was going to the grocery store. I needed some food. I walk in and understand living in Rome, when I go to the grocery store, quote, grocery store, they don't really have them in the same way. It was like the size of this stage and there were two options for cereal, neither of which are available in the United States. I've looked, which is disappointing. They're really good. So I walk into Walmart and I see the aisle. In fact, it's actually misleading to say the aisle of cereal because it's actually two, at least, aisles of cereal. And I walk up and I see it and I was like, nope. And I just walked away. I was like, I'm not dealing with that. Like, I don't want to have to like figure out which one I want to eat. I was like, I'll just, you know, have coffee. I don't need this. So then I walk over because I needed some meat, like cold cuts, right? And they didn't have a deli. So I walk over and there's all the different packages and there's all the different options. And I looked at it and I was like, oh my gosh, I can find out how much each costs, not only its overall cost, but per ounce. And then there's the ingredients and which one's healthier. And then there's the expiration date. And again, I was just like, oh my goodness. I started like doing calculus in my mind, trying to figure out which one I should buy. And finally, I just walked out of Walmart. I didn't buy a thing. And I went to my mom's, you know, feed me, you know. I was like, I don't even know how to deal with this. Have you ever been overwhelmed by the choices in your life? I mean, some of you, you're overwhelmed just thinking about the number of choices you have to make in a single day. It's overwhelming. And I mean, have you ever sat down finally quietly at night and you just want to like pick a TV show and you just start scrolling? I mean, Carrie and I, every once in a while, it's so rare, but we have these moments where it's like, let's watch a movie. I mean, that is like once a quarter kind of thing. Like we have time for a movie and then we'll sit there and scroll through. And by the time we pick one, it's too late. Just go to bed. Forget it. Never mind. Right? And this isn't just a like introduced by the streaming world sort of phenomenon. Like some of you, I'm looking around, you're old enough to remember Blockbuster. And you walk through and it's like, what should we rent tonight? I don't know. What do you want to rent tonight? You go through all of them. We get overwhelmed by the number of options that we have in our lives. And it's so interesting because you would think that the more choices we have, the happier we'd be. Because then you could pick the perfect one, right? Is that perfect movie? It's that perfect cereal. Like if you just have all the options, we want all the options, and then we can pick the perfect one that will finally give us the happiness that we desire. Right? It's the perfect movie for that night. But actually, and studies have shown that the more options we have, the more choices we have, it actually leads us to anxiety and depression. It can. Because we get so overwhelmed and we start to analyze every decision that we make. I mean, yes, I could get Captain Crunch, but maybe I should just get Honey Nut Cheerios. And this might make me happier, but this one might make me even happier. I mean, I like this one, but this one could be even better. And what if I choose the wrong one? And so we become paralyzed, indecisive. And even whatever we end up picking, there's this little voice in the back of our head that said, maybe we picked the wrong one. We might have been happier if we picked that other movie instead. And see, this is true when you've got so many options, but can I tell you it also is true when it comes to the big decisions in life? Because what is a little bit misleading about the big decisions is that usually there's only two options. It's a yes or a no. If you think about the biggest decisions that you make in life, it's like, do I take this job? Do I not take this job? It's a yes or a no. Do I move to New Jersey? Do I not move to New Jersey? It's a yes or a no. Do I go back for seconds? Do I not go back for seconds? Right? See, these are the big decisions in life that we wrestle with. But what you know, I don't have to explain this to you, is that buried within each one of those options is a myriad of other decisions, right? All the analysis, all the pros and cons that have to be weighed and evaluated and decided, all these different pieces. And as you go through and you're calculating all of them, you get to a point where you finally have to make a decision and there's still this voice in the back of your head going, but what if I get it wrong? Like, what if you make the wrong decision and the only person you have to blame is you? The only person that you get to hold accountable for the decision that you make is you. See, we don't want to live with that kind of pressure. We'd rather avoid that. And so what happens oftentimes is we opt for the safest possible route. You play it safe because you don't want to be caught where you don't want to be. Right? You don't want to make the wrong decision and it costs you more than you want to give up. And see, this isn't a new phenomenon. Solomon, the philosopher king, as I've begun to think of him, like he looked around and he saw how paralyzing not knowing is, how paralyzing all the different choices in life can be. And how do you know? How do you decide? And so Solomon, in his wisdom, he looks around and says, look, if you don't know what to do, if you don't know the outcomes, you need to play it safe. Don't risk anything. It's the only reasonable thing to do. That's not what he said. I'm just seeing if you're paying attention. He actually said the exact opposite. He said, look, when you don't know what to do, he said, that's when you go big or go home. So in chapter 11, verse 1, look at what he says. Cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it again. I don't know about you, but bread that I throw in the water doesn't come back to me. This is amazing. This is a miracle. Right? We used to take my son Gabriel when he was really little, there was a pond near us, and we go and feed the ducks. And, you know, we all love feeding the ducks. You take the bread, you tear it up in little pieces, and the ducks eat it. But there's some of it that kind of escapes the ducks. It doesn't come back. It gets waterlogged, and eventually it sinks. Even if, let's suppose, that you cast bread on the water, I don't care what kind of bread it is, even if somehow it came back to you, it would not be edible. Right? So this is not like, Solomon, what are you talking about? You cast bread upon the waters, after many days you'll find it again. Yeah, ugh, I don't really want that. See, actually, most likely what Solomon is doing, he's using language that would have been understood in his day. This is figurative language, most likely referring to the sea trade. See, Solomon, what we know is that he had a whole fleet of ships that would sail out with goods like grain or bread and return with gold, silver, ivory after 3 years. Right? It's a long voyage all over the Mediterranean doing this trading. So they send out ships with the bread and it comes back with the riches. It comes back with everything that you want. But see, Solomon, understand, he's not saying that everyone should literally get involved in the shipping business. Right? That's the king's work. That's what he gets to do because he's the king. He's talking to all of the ordinary citizens. And so his real point here is that there are some things that you have to do, some actions that you need to take that are uncertain. They're risky, but they're worth the risk. See, in Solomon's world, if you were to put goods on a ship and send it out in the Mediterranean, you're not like calling them on the radio, like, how's it going? We're still good? So those ships sail out of sight, and you have no idea what happens to them. And there's storms that come, there's pirates, you're shipwrecked. They're all, I mean, how many, can you imagine how many ships there are lying at the bottom of the Mediterranean Ocean, or Mediterranean Sea? All right, so you send all these ships out. It is a risky venture. But then some of them come back. But see, this is why you don't put all your eggs in one basket. What does he say? Give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. You don't put all your grain on one ship. You send out hundreds. You send out all these ships, and after 3 years, some of them are going to come back. Which, by the way, is really good financial advice, isn't it? I mean, if you were to call your financial advisor, they would tell you something very similar. We don't have shipping, you know, I don't invest in shipping per se, but your financial advisor might say, listen, you need to invest in the stock market. It's risky, but it's worth the risk. But don't put all of your money in a single investment. Don't put it all in one stock. You want to diversify, right? If one crashes, the other one's okay, and this is how you mitigate against disaster. But understand that Solomon, he's not really talking about how to get a good return on your financial investment. He's talking about how to get a good return on your life. And the way you do that is to give your life away. See, this language, and it's hard for us to see this because we don't live in the ancient Near East, but this phrase in particular, give portions, and there's other parts of the Hebrew syntax that we can unpack, but this idea of give portions here, in ancient Near Eastern writings, this language was often used to refer to giving to the poor. It was to give away. It was to be generous. But look at what he says here. This is a picture of generosity in the face of disaster. Give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. That sounds a little backwards, doesn't it? I mean, Solomon, I get what you're saying, but actually it's when disaster looms, that's when we should be more cautious. We don't give away when a disaster is coming. That's when we hold more to ourselves. We need to be more conservative, less generous, save a little bit more for ourselves for that rainy day. Like Solomon, what are you talking about here? We don't want to give away when disaster strikes. Anybody hoard toilet paper during COVID? You know, or disinfectant wipes? Ice cream. Anybody hoard ice cream? Oreos, right? You need your comfort foods in the midst of a pandemic, right? You got to hoard the things that you have because you don't want to run out. So in psychology, they talk about having two different kinds of mindsets. People have either a mindset of scarcity or a mindset of abundance. And so the scarcity mindset is this idea that the resources that you have are finite. They are scarce. You can run out. So don't give too much of yourself away because you might find that you're without. You don't have what you need. Don't give too much of your time, you might run out of time. Don't give too much of your treasure, you might run out of treasure. Don't give too much of your talent, you might run out of talent. Like there's this sense of like, what I have to hoard for myself because every bit I give away is less for me. But with the abundant mindset, it's a completely different way of thinking about it. That the things that I have are replenishable. That the talent that I have, guess what? I have more talent. So I can give away talent. I can serve someone else. I can give away money because there's more money to be made. I can give away time because I've got more time at other places. Like all these things that are my resources, they are actually replenishable, so I can give them away. There's not a finite amount that I'm eventually going to run out and then I will be lost, right? And so what Solomon says here, and this is so amazing. He says the only way to guard against disaster, actually, is to be generous, is to give away. It is to give what we have. Cast your bread out on the waters and trust that it will make its way back to you somehow, some way. Give portions away to the nth degree. That's what he says in the seventh or the eighth, right? It's the nth. How far would you go giving away to a point that it even seems unreasonable? Because what Solomon understood is that God is a God of abundance, not scarcity. See, if you don't believe in God, then you're gonna run out. Like, I get why you'd have a scarcity mindset if you don't believe in a God who creates. But if you believe in a God who has created all things, as we're gonna see later, he's the maker of all things, then God is the God of abundance, not scarcity. And so what we have this opportunity to do is to cast this bread out, to give our lives away generously to the nth degree, to a degree that the world would say is unreasonable and even foolish, because we believe that God never runs out. By the way, though, oftentimes the way that God makes sure that we have what we need, it's not because God shows up at our doorstep in the flesh and hands us something. He does it in the context of community. So in 2 Corinthians 1, I think this is such a critical passage here for understanding how God works in the world and how he works through us. This is the Apostle Paul, and he writes this, chapter 1, verse 3, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God." Do you see this pattern? See, this is God, who is the God of all comfort, right? He's the source of all comfort. He comforts us so that we, in turn, can comfort other people. See, God doesn't just go around comforting everyone. Paul could have said that, if that's what he wanted to say. God could go around comforting everyone equally. God could do that. And he does comfort in all sorts of ways, but one of the primary ways that God comforts us is when we comfort one another. He says, "I'm going to comfort you so that you can be a comfort to others. I'm going to bless you so you can be a blessing. I'm going to give to you so that you can give to others." That is the pattern. Have you ever considered the fact that you might, as you pray for someone else, that you might be the answer to your own prayer? You might be praying for someone else to be encouraged, and you're like frustrated. "God, why won't you encourage them?" And God's going, "I'm waiting for you. I'm sending you. Like, get off your tush and go encourage them." I mean, there's times where we're praying for other people, and listen, I'm all for prayer. And there are things that only God can do. There are healing, people who are sick, we're praying for healing. That's something only God can do. I can't heal anybody. But there are other times we're praying, "Man, God, I hope you provide for their needs." And he's like, "Yeah, guess who I'm going to provide so that you can provide? I'm going to give you what you need so you can help somebody else out. God, man, I really hope that you can, you know, fix their car." And God's like, "Yeah, do you know somebody who can fix a car? Maybe it's you. Lord, I'm praying for somebody. They're really going through a hard time. They just need somebody to sit in silence and walk alongside them as they need it." And he's like, "Yeah, you're the answer to that prayer. Don't wait for me. Go. I'm answering your prayer, but it's you. You want to comfort somebody? You want God to comfort them? Maybe, just maybe, he's waiting for you to go and be the answer to the prayer that you're praying." But see, to give your life away like that, it's still risky. It doesn't change the fact that it still can be scary to give our lives away. Right? When you step into an uncomfortable position with somebody else, an uncomfortable space where they're going through hurt or loss, maybe they're not sure how they're going to get through another day. Maybe there's a struggle that you honestly are not equipped for. It is overwhelming for you, and yet you still have an opportunity to step into that space and to be the presence of God to them. And in doing that, you may not know how it's going to play out. You don't know how it's going to work out. You can't say, "Oh, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to comfort this person. Everything's going to be fine." You don't know that. We don't know how God may choose to work. You don't know if the bread you cast out will find its way back or not. And this is what Solomon wants us to see in this next few verses, is just the limits of our own knowledge, to see the ignorance that we have about the things that we do in the world that we live in. So in verse 3, he says, "If clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth." All right, we get that. "Where a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it will lie." Okay, I get that too. "Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap." What Solomon is telling us here is that there are certain patterns in life that will help us predict outcomes. We can look at the weather, generally speaking, have an idea of what is going to happen. You can look at the clouds and say, "Look, they're thick with rain. They're dark. It's gonna rain. Probably it will." And once a tree has fallen, we don't have to wonder like where that tree's gonna go, right? Well, it's on the ground. It's there. It's not gonna get up and walk away. It's not gonna roll over by itself. But see, there are other uncertainties in life that we can't mitigate. So yes, when the tree lands, we know exactly where it is. We can now plan around that reality that the tree is lying on the ground. But before the tree falls, it's standing up. We don't know which way it's going to fall exactly. We could guess. But there's all sorts of variables that we might not be able to predict. And sometimes the clouds look like they're full of rain, and it never rains. And so the temptation then is to wait until we know for sure, to wait for the optimal conditions, right? Whoever watches the wind, it's like, what's going to happen? Will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. My dad told me this story years ago, and it's just hung with me all of my life. When we lived in Texas, he was a partner in an architecture firm, And they hired a new architect who seemed to have a very bright future. They just got him out of architecture school, very gifted, very talented, very bright. And so they gave him his first assignment, right? His first project. He was going to do it all by himself. And he was super excited about it, super jazzed. And so he goes and he begins to research this project. After a week later, they brought him in and they said, all right, what are you thinking? What's your design plan? He said, you know, I'm not quite there yet. I'm still in the research phase. I'm still learning everything that there is to know about this project and all the variables. And they said, okay, that's fine. Remember, there's a deadline out here. So we're going to give you another week and then let's touch base. Let's see where you are. So he goes back and does some more research. They call him back in. They're like, okay, so show us your initial design. Show us where you've landed now. He says, yeah, I'm still not quite there. I'm still doing this research, really making sure I understand all of how this could work and even the history of that area, and I'm just learning more and more. They said, okay, that's good, but there's a deadline coming and you need to put something on paper. And so he leaves again. They bring him back, and again he says, yeah, I've just gotten started. And they said, you're fired. You never put pen to paper. See, I can tell you right now that the only guarantee of failure is if you never try. Right? You're never going to hit the ball if you never swing the bat. You're never going to get the job if you never apply. Right? You have, at some point, you have to move into the future. And there are some of you that maybe you just even sense that God has put something on your heart. He's calling you into this new space, but there's this fear that is holding you back as you're trying to analyze all the different variables. You're trying to figure out, is this really what I need to do? Or maybe you're playing the if-only game, or once this happens game. You ever play that? It's like, you know, once I get this much job security, then I'll do it. Once my kids are this old, then I'll do it. Once we're in this stage of life, then I'll do it. And we're waiting on God, and he's like, you haven't passed me by, I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you to move forward. It's like, and then I'm gonna supply for all of your needs, because you can't know everything. If you wait till you know everything, you'll never do anything. And see, we don't know everything. And in fact, that's actually a very comfortable place to be. We shouldn't know everything. Look at verse 5. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. If Solomon were here, it would be tempting to say, Solomon, you're so behind. You're so behind modern science. We can totally track the wind, the path of the wind, like no problem. We can see weather patterns. We can put it on big charts. We can put it on big screens. We can show everybody how the wind is going to be going. And we know how babies are formed. Solomon, you're adorable. You're so old. You have no idea what we know now. And Solomon, he'd probably be really impressed. And then he'd say, you know, what I can't help but notice is that everything you know is just copying what God already did. Everything you can do, you're just using things that he already made. It's November, which for me means I'm thinking about Thanksgiving. I don't know about you. I love Thanksgiving. My daughter was asking me this week, which do you like better? And she was doing all these different games. You know, it was like this color versus this color, or this game versus this game. And she said, which do you like better, Christmas or Halloween? I said, this is easy, Christmas, not even a question. She says, how about Christmas and Thanksgiving? And I paused. It's like, ooh, that's tough, you know, because I love Thanksgiving. And I will be honest, it is about the food. I'm just being transparent with you. I love eating at Thanksgiving. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. It's a gift from God. If you've been reading Ecclesiastes, eat something good and give praise to God for what he's given to you. And when we have the opportunity to go to my parents' house, my mom, she loves to bake pies. I think she loves to eat pies as well, but she loves to bake pies, and her pie to person ratio is absurd, okay? I'm just telling you, like it's almost one-to-one. You know, there's so many pies that she likes to make. But one of the questions that has haunted me is when you talk about pies that are made from scratch, how from scratch are we talking? Right? Is there a spectrum of from scratch? I mean, I understand in one very general sense, you might say, well, this pie was store-bought versus this one that's from scratch. Or maybe you might even go so far as to say, well, this one's store-bought, and then there's kind of a middle ground where this was, we used something out of a box or a can, whereas this one is from scratch. And like, where is that line? You know, are there rules? Are there guidelines to what is from scratch? Maybe there's a strict definition that of which I am unaware. But see, I wonder if what I think of as from scratch, is that basically the equivalent of somebody else's store-bought? Like, I don't know. And when we talk about from scratch, I mean, like, if you say that, like, how do you mean it? Like, do you mean when you made that apple pie from scratch that you grew the apples? Like, did you peel them and you diced them up and you put them in there? Like, did you get the grain and make the crust from hand? Like, is that from scratch? Like, where do we draw these lines? See, strictly speaking, the only person who gets to say they make anything from scratch is God. If you want to make something from scratch, you have to create a universe. Because everything that you're using, he already made. It's like the old joke of the scientist who said, God, we've had this breakthrough. We can create humanity from dirt just like you. And God says, that's amazing. Let me see it. And the guy bends down and he starts to get some dirt and form it into a human. And God says, whoa, 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 not so fast. Get your own dirt. See, there's so much that we will never know. Right? And there's so much that we can't control. But instead of that being a negative, instead of that being leading to paralysis and us going, oh no, I don't know, and I gotta hunker down and hoard everything that I have, Solomon says just the opposite. He says, actually, within the ignorance of the future, within the ignorance of not knowing how everything will play out, actually there's an incredible opportunity to live for freedom, for courage, for creativity. Because if you knew everything that was gonna happen to you, you would never live by faith. This is why he concludes this way in verse 6. He says, sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let not your hands be idle, for you don't know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. He says, you don't know how your decisions are going to play out. You don't know whether it's going to succeed or failure, but instead of that being an excuse to be passive or to do nothing, he says, instead, it's because we don't know how everything is going to work out that we should act boldly. He doesn't say unwisely. Right? Let's just be clear. He's not saying, look, just do stupid things. Right? He's not saying, don't look before you leap. He's talking about calculated risk. Our problem, though, is not with the calculated part. Right? We do the calculated pretty well. It's the risk part that we're afraid of. We're great at calculating. How many of us are overthinkers in this room? How many of us can absolutely suffocate a good decision by overthinking of it? Right? How have you ever considered or thought about how fast you can talk yourself out of doing the right thing? It happens in a blink. Now you can see the right thing right in front of you, staring you in the face, and within the time you can think about what it even is, your brain has come up with half a dozen reasons why that doesn't apply to you. Like, you don't need to do that. It's amazing the processing power of our brains when we're trying to avoid taking a risk or doing the right thing. It's incredible. It's astounding. And see, Solomon, he says, listen, we've got the calculated part down. It's the risk part that we tend to be so afraid of because we don't want whatever we do to either fail or cost us anything. And see, Solomon, he's turning this whole framework upside down. And instead of saying, well, I'm not going to do anything because I don't know how it's going to play out, he says, it's time to risk something. It's time to have the courage to step out in faith. It's time to dare. Because without risk, there is no reward. And if you want to put that into biblical language, it's without faith, there is no pleasing God. Faith and risk are one and the same. I was thinking about this week that I think one of the worst things that could happen to a person is to have early success in life. Because when you succeed early, you begin to think that you should only ever succeed. And you will be tempted to be risk averse. You've only known success, and so you don't ever want to know the bitter taste of failure. And by the way, moms and dads who are listening right now, this is why you must never shelter your kids from failure. Because you will steal from them the very learning opportunities that God wants them to experience through failing, through making mistakes. See, if you want to grow into the person that God has created you to be, then you have to act in faith. You have to make mistakes. You have to be willing to risk failure and even spectacular failure. And then be willing to get up off the mat and try again. I think, and this is going to sound strange, but I think sometimes we spend way too much time worrying about God's will. You're never going to perfectly know God's will. Can I just tell you right now? You do not know the mind of God. He is on heaven and we are on earth. You're not going to solve this thing, but we get so wrapped up in it. Is this God's will? I don't know. Let's analyze everything. Let's tear everything apart. We overthink it and we kill the decision, right? We spend all this time worrying about God, what God's will is. Can I tell you that, just let me lovingly tell you, get over yourself. Okay, you are not going to upset God's will. Like, God is sovereign. You are not going to do something. He's like, oh man, there it went. My whole plan turned upside down. Oh man, if only they'd spent a little bit more time analyzing this decision, maybe they would have seen I wanted them to go left, not right. You know, it's like, oh, sorry, God, I had no idea. Sometimes we start to think that God has this, he deals with this like in these binaries where he's like a game show host. And here's the two doors staring you in the face. Here's option one, it's the perfect will of God. Man, I hope they choose that one. This one is the Bengal tiger that will eat them, right? And he's like, man, I hope you choose the right door. God isn't playing that game with you. He's not waiting back to see and then to see whether he can, like, you know, bludgeon you because you picked the wrong one. He wants you to follow him in faith. And so you take a bold step, you take a risk, and you walk through that door, whatever it is, and then you trust that he's going to redirect you. And part of that, by the way, is going to be making mistakes. He will let you fail. He will let you mess things up. He will let you experience pain and even hurt other people. He will let all those things happen because he is concerned with what he is doing inside of you, not just what he wants to do outside of you. Right? This is how he grows our character. And he makes us into the men and the women who look more and more and more like Jesus. And by the way, look, if you have a heart after Jesus, okay, Augustine said it great. Love God and do what you please. In other words, if you're just trying to follow God, like, how messed up can you get it? Like, how wrong can you be? Oh God, I was just so compassionate. It was just too compassionate. I don't know, right? I was just too loving. I was too generous. I forgave way too quickly. That's what got me, God. I'm so sorry. I've ruined your will. See, the mistakes that we make, listen to me, the mistakes we make are mistakes of scarcity, not abundance. The mistakes we make are scarcity as we withhold. Rarely do we make mistakes of abundance where we simply give too freely. See, and it might not work out exactly the way you want. That's what Solomon's saying. You can't predict the future. You can't know all of this. But God can take what little bits that we get right and he can make them extraordinary. Don't be paralyzed by what you don't know. Act on what you know. You know that God is good. You know that he loves you. Follow him like that and let him take care of the rest. This last week, we were watching the World Series. I know that we were like the only family in New Jersey watching the World Series. You guys all gave up a couple of weeks ago. I get it. I've been a Rangers fan all my life on the AL side. Just to be clear, my loyalty's on the NL. It's all good. I'm pulling for the Phillies. My heart was in it. I was very upset. Not devastated. Upset when the Diamondbacks beat them. I was thrilled that the Rangers got revenge for them and dispersed with that horrible team down from Arizona. All right, anybody from Arizona, I apologize now. But we were watching the game, and the Rangers, if you didn't catch any of this, it's okay. But the Rangers did something incredible. They never lost on the road. They went into every stadium and won. Like, I don't think that had ever been done before. So they went 11-0 on the road. And it was, we were watching the games, though. We were watching the different stadiums. And the Diamondback Stadium, you probably saw this if you're watching the Phillies, one of the most unusual stadiums because it has a pool and a hot tub in the outfield. How weird is that? That is so weird. It was so great. My kids were like, what is that? One of my younger kids was like, does ever stadium have a pool and a hot? I was like, no, it's just those weird Diamondbacks. I don't know what that's about. But doesn't that look kind of fun? Like, you can just splash around in the pool, enjoy the hot tub while you're watching the game. It's the only thing better than being in the pool and a hot tub, can I just tell you, is to be on the field. Because at the end of this, those people were happy. They got to watch their team. Well, actually, they weren't. They lost. Ha ha. So they weren't happy. But other games, like, they get to watch their team play. That's kind of nice. They get to enjoy that, right? But see, the players, yeah, there's the possibility of failure, but there's also the possibility of the spectacular, of making history. And I want you to understand that God did not create you to be a spectator in your own life. He did not create you to be a spectator of all that he is doing in the world. He created you to play the game, to get on the field, to risk something. Every time you step into the batter's box, or you get on the field, yeah, you might strike out, you might make an error, you might be the reason your team loses the game, but it's only in the possibility of failure that you can see the reality of success, of the spectacular, of the extraordinary. One of my favorite stories in scripture that I come back to all the time is when Jesus, he's out walking on water, and he looks over and there's the disciples in the boat, and Peter says, "Lord, call me out onto the water." And Jesus incredibly says, "Okay, come on out." He says, "Come out on the water, come join me." Can you imagine what it would have been like to be Peter? To step out of that boat and to begin to walk on the water in your brain. I just imagine your brain trying to process the impossible. You're watching it. And at some point, in fact, it's so overwhelming that his brain can't keep up. And he goes, "Wait a minute, this can't be real, this can't be happening." And he begins to look at the wind and the waves and he starts to sink, and Jesus lifts him up and Jesus gives him this really mild little rebuke. He's like, "Oh, you have little faith, right? Like, why did you look away? Like, just keep your eyes on me." But have you ever thought about how that story was told later? If you thought about how different it would be if you were Peter telling the story versus one of the disciples in the boat telling the story. You know, the disciples, they're sitting in the boat and maybe they like the way they get to tell it because they could be like, "Man, it was incredible. We saw Peter. He's out there walking in the water, but he started sinking. It was great. And then Jesus had to save his life." And they conveniently forget that Peter was the only one with the courage to get out of the boat. See, I don't want to be the person sitting in the boat. I want to be the person who has the courage to get out of the boat when Jesus calls. I say, "Yeah." In fact, I love that Peter actually said, "Jesus, call to me." That's boldness. That's audacity. See, I got to tell you, I think we have this really domesticated view of faith. We start to think that the church is like the hot tub, where we're going to like sit in here and we're going to kind of soak and bask and it's so nice. And we get to come in here and hear sweet little songs and sermons that make us happy. Not my sermons, but other people's. My sermons rarely make anybody happy. You know, we get to be nice to everybody. We're like, we're living by faith. Can I tell you? I think if that's your idea of living by faith, then God is bored to tears with your life. Living by faith is not boring. Living by faith is risky. There is no such thing as safe faith. See, I don't want to be the guy sitting in the boat who years later goes, "Yeah, I mean, I had the chance to walk on water, but I just never really got out of the boat. I prefer to just sit right there." I don't want to be the person who throws stones at the people who have the courage to try, and yeah, they fail, sometimes miserably, and are embarrassed, but they at least had the courage to get out of the boat. See, that's the life that I want. That's the life that I want for you. That's the life that I want for us. That we would have the kind of lives that make the world sit up and take notice. See, when Jesus came and he gave his life, when Jesus, think about this, he broke through the fabric of time and space in order to get to us. And he risked everything. He gave up all that he had in heaven, right? The riches of heaven. He gave up all that, put it all on the line to come here, to be with us, to risk his life, to go to the cross. He didn't do that so we could play it safe. He didn't do that so we could have our little shrink-wrapped lives and we could be safe and hunker down and hoard everything that we have. He did that so that we would know how loved we are, and out of that security of knowing that our future is secure because of how he's loved us, we would then have the audacity and the courage to give our lives away. Jesus came so that we could experience life to the full, abundant life, not normal life. Can I tell you what normal life is? Normal life is apathy. That's normal. Bitterness is normal. Fear is normal. Greed is normal. I don't want normal. I don't want normal for you. I want abnormal. I want to look like Jesus, right? Jesus didn't live a normal life. I want loving our enemies. That's the kind of life I want us to have. There's nothing normal about that. Being generous to the nth degree. That's not normal. I don't want normal. I want the life that only God can give, and that's the life that I want us to have as a church, as a people. Because we know how the story ends. We may not know how all the story unfolds, all right? We don't know that. We don't know all the details. I can't tell you how your life is going to go this afternoon, much less in 10 years. I have no idea, neither do you. But what we do know is the end of the story, and Jesus wins. And so in the meantime, What an amazing opportunity that God has given to us to live boldly, to live with courage, to dare, so that we can get a good return on our lives. That's what I want. How about you? I don't want my life to be for nothing. I want a good return on the life that I have and the time that I have it. Church, I love you. I'm praying for you. This is what I'm praying for us, that we become this kind of a people, that we wouldn't settle for the normal. We would pursue the insanity of Jesus. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. These guys are gonna play a song. We're gonna distribute the elements. We're gonna take communion together. And let me just say this. Look, if you're here with us this morning and you have given your life to Jesus, if you have trusted in him for the forgiveness of your sins and for the hope of eternal life, then I don't care whether you're a member of Easton, it's okay. You're part of our family. You're welcome to join us. If you're here this morning though, and you've never given your life to Jesus, if you don't know what it is to know the freedom that only he offers, the forgiveness that only he offers, the hope that only he offers, then instead of taking communion with us, let me give you a better way to use your time. Just think about it. Just think about who Jesus says he is, the very Son of God who came to give his life for you. And then afterwards, I would love to talk to you about how you can step into a relationship with him. So I hope you'll take this time to do that. Let me pray for us. Jesus, you came and you said it so many times, don't be afraid. You came so that we would not live lives of fear or timidity, but that we would live lives of boldness, of risk, because we are absolutely certain of who you are and we live by faith. And Lord, what we desire is to get out of the boat, that we would cast our bread out freely. We would give portions of ourselves away, portions of our lives away, and we don't know how we're gonna get it back, but we know that God, you are the God of abundance, not scarcity, and you will provide for all of our needs. And that's why you've given us this amazing community where we get to lift each other up. We get to be comfort to one another. We get to be encouragement to one another. We get to be those who rally alongside one another and provide for each other's needs, because as you have given to us, we give to one another freely. And Lord, I pray that that would then extend into this world, that we would live lives that are conspicuous, that cause the world to take notice, that we would not settle for normal. So Jesus, as we receive this communion, as we're reminded of what this symbolizes, your death for us, that this would sink ever deeper into our soul and continue just to remake us into your image. That we would be once again absolutely in awe of the depth of your sacrifice for us, of how you have given your life for us, and that out of that then we could give our lives as well. It's in your name we pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's message and that God will use it to speak powerfully into your life. If you have questions about how you can have a relationship with Jesus or would like more information about our church, you can connect with us on Instagram and Facebook or go to the Easton Bible Church website at ebc.org.